for us, Tom Service.
Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall, a corner of South Kensington that will be forever Czech. Well, tonight at least. We're going to hear the BBC Symphony Orchestra and their Czech chief conductor, Jiří Bělohlávek, play two pieces that are pretty well the masterpieces of late 19th century Czech music. Before the interval, Dvořák's irresistible lyrical cello concerto. And in the second half, the six tone poems that make up Smetana's Má Vlast, My Country. Now, I'm almost ashamed to tell you all that it's taken up right until now, the 117th season of the Proms, for Má Vlast to be played complete here. Just as well, then, that the piece couldn't be in more qualified hands than Bělohlávek's. But it's Dvořák we're going to hear first. Now, as Stephen Johnson's programme note for the cello concerto points out, and you can read it, like all the others, for previous Proms at bbc.co.uk/proms, cello concertos weren't exactly ten a penny in the late 19th century. In fact, there's a great description from the critic Neville Cardus, writing as late as 1939. He talks about the wasp-in-the-window effect, which most times we have to put up with whenever a solo cellist gets to work. Well, maybe the Dvořák can't have been that famous by then. After all, this was the concerto that made Johannes Brahms exclaim, "Why on earth didn't I know that one could write a cello concerto like this? If only I had known, I'd have written one long ago." Dvořák completed the piece in 1895, towards the end of a three-year stay in the United States of America. And the genius of the whole concerto is the way that Dvořák's orchestration, and looking down on the concert platform here, it's a pretty big band the cello's got to compete against. Three trombones, tubas, big woodwind section, even a triangle and some cymbals and a bass drum in the percussion section there. All of that stuff never gets in the way of the solo cello line. Tonight's soloist is the young French cellist Jean-Guyen Queyras.
This concerto has a very, very special place in our repertoire. So it was a huge revolution because it's the first time that the cello is the speaker of an incredibly moving and long drama, you know, and we have the main character. And that, of course, all this autobiography that's in there, you know, that Dvořák with his longing for his country, his longing for Kournikova, his former lover, and then learning that she died before he came back and all these things. And he put all these things in there.
Tonight's soloist, Jean-Guyen Queyras. The final movement, or the slow movement and the final movement, parts of that music, there's a very mysterious section right before the end of the concerto, slow music just before the coda of the finale of Dvořák's cello concerto, which is a lament when he'd heard about the death of his sister-in-law, who was then called Josefina Kalnitsova. Dvořák fell in love with her first and then married her sister. Applause now here in the Royal Albert Hall for the leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra tonight, Andrew Haverin. It is a complete miracle, this concerto, as I'm sure you're about to hear. The way that the orchestra is never less than epic in scale, and yet at the heart of the piece is this lyrical song that the whole concerto seems to sing. More silence in the Royal Albert Hall as we await the arrival of tonight's soloist and conductor. And coming on stage now, the young French cellist Jean-Guyen Queyras, and the BBC Symphony Orchestra's chief conductor, Jiří Bělohlávek, to play Dvořák's cello concerto.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dvorak's Cello Concerto here at the Royal Albert Hall. Jean-Guyen Keras, the soloist. The BBC Symphony Orchestra was conducted by Jiří Bělochlava. Jiří Bělochlava bringing his orchestra, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, to their feet. That performance was remarkable for its lyrical intensity. And in the story of the 24 times that this concerto has previously been played in the 116 previous seasons of the Proms, one in particular stands out. On the 21st of August 1968, Vyacheslav Rostropovich played Dvořák's Cello Concerto with the USSR State Symphony Orchestra and Yevgeny Svetlanov, a performance that was a tour of a Soviet ensemble, but that was the very day that the Soviet tanks rolled into Prague to try and quell the Prague Spring government in Czechoslovakia at the time. Rostropovich played with tears in his eyes that night. There were dissidents outside the hall, protests, and a feeling of unrest inside the hall too. It's a performance, actually, whose hyper-intensity you can hear on a recording. It's released on the BBC Legends label, but every performance here resonates with that signal performance of that intensity on the 21st of August 1968. Still, huge applause and thumping feet for Jean-Guyen Keras. Comes on stage again with Jiří Bělochlava and presents the soloist to the audience with whoops and whistles of delight. You know, it's a bit disingenuous that old Brahms said that if I'd known you could write a cello concerto like that, I'd have written one long ago. That was 1895 when Brahms saw the score of this piece. But about 8 years earlier, he'd written a cello concerto, all right, one that had a solo violin too, the double concerto, which you heard last night with the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France and the Capuçon Brothers. A performance, of course, you can hear on the iPlayer. Fascinating that the moments at which that concerto becomes most intimate, most lyrical, have an autobiographical resonance for Dvorak. The song that he quotes in the after those very stern moments in the brass and the slow movement is a song that his sister-in-law loved. Oh, we're going to get an encore. Jean-Guyen Keras.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Bach, suite number 2, Sarabande. Thank you.
Well, he announced it himself. Jean-Guyen Quiras played the Saraband from Bach's Solo Cello Suite No. 2. Amazing the intimacy that this hall can take. You know, it's completely full tonight. Everywhere I look, people coloured in, people wearing T-shirts, shirts. The whole of London humanity is here, you know, and there's just that sense of focus on the tiny, relatively small sounds that a solo cello makes. 6,000 sets of ears completely focused on that performance, as I'm sure you were too at home. Jean-Guyen Quiras accepting applause from the audience here on his own now, and warm applause too from the orchestra, especially the cello section, I note. Well, that brings us to interval time tonight, and now it's time to join Rana Mitter for tonight's Proms Plus Literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello, and welcome to tonight's Proms Plus Literary event. We've just heard the wonderful Dvorak Cello Concerto in B minor. And of course, in the repertoire, the cello strings have provided rosin-laden inspiration for everyone from Elgar to Shostakovich. But it's not so obvious that the cello also has a second life on the printed page. One recent work of fiction, Stephen Galloway's novel The Cellist of Sarajevo, drew on the Balkan Wars of the 1990s to tell the tale of a musician who played his instrument in the besieged city in the face of deadly sniper fire from the nearby hills. But there was something particularly poignant about the instrument that he chose. Even more than the trumpet or the violin, there's something about the low, noble notes of the cello that seems to speak to the poignancy and fragility of human existence. But why have writers chosen to bring this particular instrument into their narratives? Well, to answer this question, I'm delighted to be joined by a critic with many strings to her bow. Peggy Reynolds teaches at Queen Mary, University of London, and is a regular broadcaster on arts and music. And also with us are the cellist Charles Martin to give us musical illustrations, along with the pianist Helen Crayford. Please welcome them all. Now, Peggy, I'd actually like to start with a rather unlikely pairing, because Shakespeare and the cello don't really go together in most of our minds, but maybe we ought to be thinking again.
Well, this came out of something where I began to think, well, where would I find the earliest cello? And of course, really and truly, the cello repertoire doesn't come into being until much later on. But I looked at Shakespeare thinking, well, where is there lots of music in Shakespeare? And of course the answer was Twelfth Night. It begins, after all, with, if music be the food of love, play on. But then, when I looked again, I realized that in Act 1, Scene 3, you have this very interesting moment when Sir Toby Belch, who you will all remember, is the roistering knight, the uncle of Olivia, who's mourning her dead brother and cloistered herself up. And he's introduced into the household one Sir Andrew Aguecheek, who he has a fancy should marry his niece. She's not interested, I have to say. And the servant, Maria, says to Sir Toby, why have you introduced this dreadful man at this particular moment? And he answers her, he's as tall as any man in Deliria. And I thought, Maria says, what's that to the purpose? But of course, we're not talking about height here. Because then it goes on. He plays the viol de gamboys. Now, I know the viol de gamboys is not a cello, but it is the forerunner of the modern cello. It's quite different in terms of strings and all that sort of thing. But then I realized that there was a sort of pun in there as well, because, of course, it's the viol de gamboys, because it's gamb, like, you know, leg in Spanish. And in particular, in 16th century slang, it was gam was leg for a was slang for a female leg. And then you get a bit down further, and they start talking about Sir Andrew's hair. And Sir Toby says, it hangs like flax on a distaff, and I hope to see a housewife take thee between her legs and spin it off. And then there's stuff about doing a caper and playing the galliard and showing an excellent leg. And none of this is about music.
I mean, Peggy, let's get absolutely to the point here. When we're talking about taking the instrument, placing it between the legs and so forth, we're talking about something really rather raunchy here, aren't we?
We are. And you've got to remember that Shakespeare was a man who adored his words, his puns, his wordplay, and this is what is going on here.
And Charles, I mean, this is obviously something that is a little bit before the time of the cello that you're showing us there, but You have, I think, got something for us that shows us the kind of music that we might have actually heard in Shakespeare's time. What's the piece of music that you've gone for?
Well, it's a little piece I composed myself, actually. I wanted to give a kind of atmosphere of what it was like in maybe the inns rather than the courts and the country houses. And so if we want a little bit of ribaldry, I focused on the hurdy-gurdy, which is, of course, a stringed instrument which is played by winding a handle, and the strings vibrate on a wheel. And it was a very popular instrument in those times, and it goes right back to, well, the earliest ones go back to the 11th century. But this is how I imagine they would have sounded in one of your roadside inns.
Raunchy and rumbustious that certainly was, I have to say, Charles. And,
yes, you can hear Sir Toby and Sir Andrew getting up to all sorts of things with that kind of...
Flagons of ale all over the shop, I have to say. But the 19th century is really when the English novel takes off as a genre, and the cello also really begins to come into its own at that particular point. And Peggy, it's Anthony Trollope who brings the two together in his novel The Warden. And I think he uses a particular phrase about the cello. He calls it the most melancholy of instruments.
He does. And as I've been working through the cello, and I was quite surprised to find this major part played by the cello in The Warden, it's become clear to me that people who play the cello are good people. There you are, Charles. They're honest, they're trustworthy, they're sensitive. And this is very much the case in The Warden. The story concerns a reverend gentleman called Septimus Harding, and he is the warden of a group of almshouses. And the charity that pays his money, pays his wage, has done so well that he is getting the grand sum of £800 a year, but spending very little on the men who are living in his almshouse. And somebody decides that this is most improper. It's a kind of 19th century version of politicians' expenses scandal. But the warden himself plays the cello, and he has made a beautiful book of sacred music at vast expense, and this has been his one guilty pleasure. And when he's agitated, interestingly, Trollope portrays him as doing air cello playing with lots of finger work when he's very worked up, and then calming himself down with gentle bowing. But there is one little concert that I thought was very lovely, where he's describing a group of people playing together. Away they go in full flow of harmony together, uphill and down dale, now louder and louder, then lower and lower, now loud as though stirring the battle, then low as though mourning the slain. In all, through all, and above all, is heard the violoncello. Ah, not for those nothing were those pegs so twisted and retwisted. Listen, listen. Now alone, that saddest of instruments tells its touching tale. Silent and in awe stand fiddle, flute, and piano to hear the sorrows of their wailing brother.
So clearly, the 19th century is a period which has, amongst other things, a great interest in folk music. And a particular piece, The Ashgrove, shows how the cello could be used as part of that particular musical trend. Charles?
Yes. Folk music, of course, was a huge thing in the 18th and 19th centuries. And you talked of melancholy. And, well, The Ashgrove is a very melancholy song. It's about the lady whose love lies underneath the soil. And very, very sad. So I thought it was very appropriate to play this piece.
Thank you.
And in the 20th century, that theme of melancholy associated with the cello really does continue. And I'm wondering, Peggy, am I stretching it to say that the cello seems to symbolise the melancholy of the world, or at least the Western world, after the Great War, this wrenching historical event? One example that comes to mind is almost a sort of small section of the novel Goodbye, Mr. Chips, by James Hilton, published in 1934, though, of course, set in a slightly earlier era, and perhaps actually, to be honest, more famous to many people through the film, which starred Robert Donat and Greer Garson.
Yes, unforgettable. I expect lots of people here will remember it. Wonderful film. Quite agree. Yeah. Actually, you're absolutely right, because, of course, even if you look at your programs for tonight, for tonight's concert, you will see that it says that the cello really comes into its own at the end of the 19th century into the 20th century. That's the moment when all the great composers begin to start writing concertos for it. So in a way, James Hilton did know exactly what he was doing here. Well, I hardly need to begin to tell you the story of Goodbye, Mr. Chips. You're absolutely right. It is published in 1934. In fact, it is set a little bit earlier. Mr. Chipping, as he is really and truly, is a kind of mediocre schoolmaster in a public school. And he muddles through his career until this amazing moment. The whole novel is set around the fact that he's dying, he's fading, and he's looking back over his memories. In middle age, he meets this astonishing young woman, Catherine, and marries her. And I'll just read you a little bit of this when he first meets her. She is, I should tell you, a strong-minded woman. She is a new woman. They first meet when she's riding her bicycle and she runs him over in the Lake District. He had never met anyone like her. He had always thought that the modern type, this new woman business, would repel him. And here she was, making him positively look forward to the glimpse of her safety bicycle careering along the lakeside road. And she, too, had never met anyone like him. She had always thought that middle-aged men who read the Times and disapproved of modernity were terrible bores. Yet here he was, claiming her interest and attention for far more than youths of her own age. Within a week, they were head over heels in love. Well, of course, they do get married. And the point of us telling you this story is that Catherine plays the cello. As I say, it's always the really good people who tend to play the cello. So as Chips, because he's always called Mr. Chips by the boys and indeed by Catherine herself, remembers her, this is what it says. And so it stood, a warm and vivid patch in his life, casting a radiance that glowed in a thousand recollections. Catherine, scampering along the stone corridors, laughing beside him at some howler in an essay he was marking. Taking the cello part in a Mozart trio for the school concert, her creamy arm sweeping over the brown sheen of the instrument. She had been a good player and a fine musician.
And it seems to me, Peggy, that, I mean, you've mentioned that the character of Catherine is a new woman, something new and feisty in the late 19th, early 20th century. Is there a connection there between the sort of gendering of the instrument, the fact that men and women perhaps play in different sorts of ways, and the emergence of this new type of female character?
I think undoubtedly there is, because there's something very bold, very striking. I mean, not to say that Charles isn't looking very striking here, but you know, to have a woman taking this instrument, which is, of course, in the shape, you know, effectively of a woman's body with its curves and all the rest of it. So the doubling of the idea of the woman's body, Charles is demonstrating for the audience, and the instrument is something that very much comes into that. And I think also the showiness of the cello is something that makes it appropriate, not just for a woman in general, but for a woman like Catherine, who wants to take the world by storm and actually wants to take up her own position in the world.
Well, Charles, you're going to pick up, I think, that theme of that feisty young cello that you've got there in your arms and use it to give us a piece that symbolises some of the happiness that emerges in that part of Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And there's a particular piece, I think, that you've chosen to try and illustrate that sort of happiness.
Yes, it's another rumbustious piece. It's by W.H. Squire, it's a tarantella, and it's strange because it's a very happy piece, but it's in a minor key, very unusual.
The tarantella has a sort of appropriateness because although it's a rambunctious piece, it also is actually a dance of death. And we do have to remember that unfortunately, it's part of the plot, of course, Mr. Chips's story does not end happily. His wife and child do die during the proceedings. And that sense of tragedy linked with the cello has also been seen in much more contemporary history. Between 1992 and 1995, of course, the city of Sarajevo in Bosnia was besieged. And a recent novel, Stephen Galloway's The Cellist of Sarajevo, used that instrument to symbolize a much wider range of emotions in a story that was actually set during the siege itself.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this is supposed to be based on a true story, recounting events that happened in 1992. And the story is that this cellist, who actually was a professional cellist and worked at the opera house in Sarajevo, was at his window when he sees a mortar shell fall on a queue of people waiting to buy bread. And 22 people are killed. And so he takes his cello downstairs. It's this portability of the cello, again, that becomes so important here. And he decides to play. Then at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 24 hours after the mortar fell on his friends and neighbors while they waited to buy bread, he will bend down and pick up his bow. He will carry his cello and stool down the narrow flight of stairs to the empty street. The war will go on around him as he sits in the small crater left at the mortar's point of impact. He'll play Albinoni's Adagio. He'll do this every day for 22 days, a day for each person killed, or at least he'll try. He won't be sure he will survive.
And again, if we think about the links to the most tragic and melancholy moments of the 20th century, one can't help but think of the teams of musicians, often string quartets and trios, that played in Nazi concentration camps during the Second World War.
Exactly. I have to say, a friend of mine knew one of them, and when she was a child, was always fascinated by the tattoo on her arm. And it is, you know, it is the melancholy sound of the cello that most poignantly and vividly evokes those difficulties, and in some ways ameliorates them, and in some ways makes a contrast which is actually, you know, even more painful, because the to have that beauty injected into a scene of such horror means that the cello is the instrument for that purpose.
So perhaps the cello as the soundtrack of the more disturbing parts of 20th century modernity.
In many ways, yes, I think that's absolutely right. I remember once a critic saying to me, of course, this is why, after the Second World War, it was the low voices that people wanted to hear. You know, it was Kathleen Ferrier, it was Vera Lynn, it was the low voices that people needed, because it was the voice of comfort, the voice of the mother. And that, in a way, exactly parallels this huge fashion for the cello.
I'm afraid we have to end the conversation here, but it has been a real pleasure. Thank you very much to my guests, Peggy Reynolds, Charles Martin, and Helen Crayford.
And that Proms Plus literary event was presented by Rana Mitter. The producer was Georgia Mann. And in next Tuesday night's Proms Plus literary event, Mark Ravenhill will be talking about the myth of Faust, one which has fascinated writers for centuries, with Matthew Sweet. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's Prom, live here on BBC Radio 3 with me, Tom Service. We're going to hear a much belated Proms first, the first time in 117 seasons that one of the most original masterpieces of late 19th century music has been heard in full here. Bedřich Smetana's cycle of six tone poems, Ma Flast. Now, the most famous section of Ma Flast has been heard here rather a lot. No surprise given the brilliance of that fantastic fluid tune in the second tone poem, Voltava. I won't sing it for you now, but you'll recognise it immediately after about 15 minutes of the second half of tonight's concert. That's Smetana's evocation of the great river that flows through Prague, the Voltava. But there's much more to Ma Flast, my country, as you'd expect from a work that depicts the entire Czech nation in sound, its history, its battles, its spirit of independence, its myths, legends, and landscapes. It's music that's part of the beating musical heart of tonight's conductor, Jiří Bělohlávek.
In the second World War, in the time of occupation by German Nazis in Prague, the piece has been banned. And for instance, Mr. Václav Talich, who was at that time the music director of Czech Philharmonic, the Nazis has tried to bribe him and to get support from him, which he refused always. And one of this attempt was that he was invited with the orchestra to Berlin. And he did agree, because it was probably impossible not to agree, but he had the condition that they will play Smetana's My Country. And it had the consequence that afterwards the authorities, they had to allow to be played it in Prague as well, when it has been played in Berlin. So that was one of the moments when the piece has been very much regarded as a big support of the resistance and of the self-esteem of the nation and the belief that the better time will come again.
Tonight's conductor, Jiří Bělohlávek. Maflás, then, a piece absolutely at the center of the Czech nation's identity. Well, Maflás begins with a mythic bardic sound, four harps, music that's a monumental evocation of the Vyšehrad, a castle on the Vltava River near Prague. And we'll hear that tune again at the crowning moments of the very final tone poem tonight, Blanik. But before then, there's that marvellous melody that starts the second piece, Vltava. Then comes the bloody matriarchal drama of the third section called Šárka, in which the heroine, Šárka, takes terrible vengeance on men, all men, for their infidelities, and a huge technicolour massacre in the orchestra. The fourth section, from Bohemia's Woods and Fields, I won't try that in Czech, starts with one of the most dazzling bits of orchestral colour ever written. A shimmering fresco for the full orchestra that's like walking through a lush Central European forest in dramatic sunlight. An absolutely, absolutely indelible moment. Then comes the two interlinked final sections, Dábor and Blanik, two battles that end, respectively, in inglorious defeat and then glorious victory. The BBC Symphony Orchestra, led by Andrew Havron, who's on stage already as they tune up, much expanded for this first full performance of Maflás. There are four of each of the woodwind players, there are more strings than usual, and four harps, where the score only really calls for two. So this is going to be a full surround sound performance of Maflás tonight. Jiří Bělohlávek was talking about the sense of Maflás being important in the 20th century for Czech identity, for Czech people. That's been true more recently too. In 1990, just after being freed from the Soviet yoke, Rafael Kubelik, the conductor, returned to Prague to conduct an unforgettable performance at the Prague Spring Festival of Maflás. So it's a piece that's symbolic of Czech identity throughout the whole, ever since its composition, and ever since its first performance in Prague in 1882. Well, here comes then tonight's conductor, Jiří Bělohlávek, to conduct the music of his homeland, Maflás.
Thank you. Thank you.
My Country, Maflast, the end of Smetana's cycle of tone poems, played complete for the very first time here at the Proms at the Royal Albert Hall. Jerzy Bielochlawek conducted the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Music of Jerzy Bielochlawek's Country, but really, we're all Czechs tonight. A fantastic reception in the hall for that music. Jerzy Bielochlawek conducted that piece, that whole 80 minutes of all six tone poems of Maflast from memory. Music he knows inside out, knows backwards. And what a huge play for this expanded BBC Symphony Orchestra. That music, that journey, that nation in sound is. Bielochlawek accepts this rapturous acclaim here at the Royal Albert Hall. Brings the orchestra to their feet. You know, if you can remember back to the way all this music started with Visegrad and the music for the four harps at the very start, one thing that Smetana does in Maflast, he only uses the harps in the first two movements. So, like the 6,000 of us here, they were mere spectators for the four succeeding tone poems. Still, not a bad place for them all to be, behind the first and second violins there, tucked in front of the timpani too. Jerzy Bielochlawek has another important position in Czech music, as well as being a strong advocate of the repertoire, not just Smetana, of course, but Janáček that I've heard in the first night of the Proms, Martinů, the set of symphonies that they've now released on record. But he takes up a position in 2012, next year, as the chief conductor of the Czech Philharmonic as well, in addition to his post here at the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Applause there for the BBC Symphony Orchestra, one of the heroes of that performance, the principal clarinetist, Richard Hosford, and the quartet of woodwinds there, the principal flute, Michael Cox, David Powell, oboe, and the bassoonist too, Graham Sheen. That wonderful moment at the start of Vltava, the most famous section of Maflast, Rob Cowan in his program note describes how the two flutes represent the warm and the cold spring from which the river Vltava springs. Quite right too, Jerzy Bielochlawek bringing up the solo timpanist John Chimes and the four harpists, Shauna Williams, Manon Morris, Sally Price and Lucy Haslam. What life-affirming music that is, and just a wonderful thing about this Proms audience. In the front row of the Proms, gripping the railing, there's a guy of about 6 foot two-ish in a black pull the neck, probably in his 30s. Next to him is a tiny wee woman, she must be in her 80s, and she has been in absolute raptures of smiles for the 80 minutes of that whole performance, gripping the thing, and she's giving Jerzy Bielochlawek the biggest salute of anyone here. Remember, you can enjoy all the Proms so far at bbc.co.uk/proms, all available to listen again for 7 days. But now, with this applause here at the Royal Albert Hall, time to hand you back to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. That was Tom's service at the Royal Albert Hall tonight with that Prom, which, as Tom was mentioning there, you can hear again by way of the radio on Friday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3 in our BBC Proms programmes in the afternoons. Every afternoon, a second chance to hear a Prom from the previous week. Tomorrow, for instance, there's a chance to hear that stunning performance of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, which was given by the Radio France Philharmonic Orchestra last night, conducted by Myung Hun Chung. The BBC Proms repeats are every afternoon from 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Or if you prefer, you can listen again anytime you'd like to for up to 7 days after they've been broadcast via the Radio 3 website.
The BBC Proms, a festival of extraordinary musical experiences.
From the 2011 BBC Proms, that most dramatic of choral works, the Verdi Requiem. Three choirs, four soloists, and the BBC Symphony Orchestra at the Royal Albert Hall. It's live on BBC Radio 3 on Sunday night from 7 o'clock.
Well, the time now is 10:10. A very good evening to you if you've risen to join us here on BBC Radio 3. Our next programme tonight is presented by Edward Sturton, who explores the life and the legacy of Cardinal Newman, whose beatification was made official by Pope Benedict in September last year during his visit to the UK. So, a profile of a very English saint in 5 minutes' time at 10:15. And a little later this evening, do stay tuned if you can to hear some pretty electrifying performances at the Latitude Festival, which took place in Suffolk last weekend. Max Reinhardt will be your guide to the music in Late Junction, which begins at 11 o'clock tonight. Music couldn't really get much more live than here on BBC Radio 3. I wonder if you heard the very first prom that took place last Friday evening and the very impressive debut of the 19-year-old pianist Benjamin Grosvenor playing one of Liszt's piano concertos. That's still available to listen to on the Radio 3 website if you hadn't already heard it. Well, here he is now to take us to our next programme tonight in music by Chopin, a nocturne. The Nocturne in C-sharp minor by Chopin. Well, we call it a nocturne, even though the man himself did not. It was played there by Benjamin Grosvenor, and I wonder if he's recovered yet from the exhilaration of making his debut at the Proms last Friday at the age of, well, very fresh 19. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 10:15. Well, last year, Pope Benedict XVI visited Britain, and one of the highlights of the trip was the beatification of Cardinal John Henry Newman, whose life spanned most of the 19th century. That's the penultimate step on the route to sainthood, and it would make Cardinal Newman the first non-martyred British saint since before the Reformation. Newman was once described as the most dangerous man in England. His religious faith took him from Protestantism to the Church of Rome, earning suspicion on all sides. He was a prolific writer and theologian who emphasised the role of the imagination and conscience. And today he's claimed by liberal and conservative Catholics alike. Even in death he attracted controversy, requesting to be buried in the same grave as his male companion of 32 years. A mystery still surrounds what happened to Newman's remains. Edward Sturton now examines the life and legacy of John Henry Newman.
In 1816, the 16-year-old John Henry Newman arrived here at Trinity College, Oxford, for the first time. He would have come in through Chapel Arch, which in those days was the main entrance to the college, into Durham Quad, a very intimate quad, which at that period was very much the heart of college life. The hall where the college would dine is just on my left, the library straight ahead, and the chapel on my right. It was the beginning of an association with Oxford that was to last for almost three decades. 1816 was a turbulent period in John Henry Newman's home life. His father's business had just gone bust. It was also a period of great turmoil in the Anglican Church. Geoffrey Rowell is an Anglican bishop and a leading Newman scholar.
There was anxiety because of the threat, as many English churchmen perceived it, to the identity of the church because of legislation that was being passed towards the end of the 1820s, relieving dissenters of disabilities, Catholic emancipation, and 1832, the Great Reform Bill, which had the effect of turning a parliament for which you had to be an Anglican in which to sit as an MP, and which of course was responsible for church legislation, into something which was no longer Anglican. Looking back, we can see it as the beginnings of the emergence of a more pluralist state and the crumbling of a confessional state. In addition to that, you have to look across the channel and the French Revolution, and was there going to be a similar revolution in England? And then, in a rather different way, the evangelical movement associated with John Wesley and Methodism, George Whitefield. If you ask about worship, it was often rather dreary, long sermons, very little in the way of anything which touched the heart, very little, perhaps, of beauty.
Newman secured a prestigious fellowship at Oriel College and very quickly found himself at the centre of the public debate about the church's future. He decided as a teenager that, as he put it, it was the will of God that I should lead a single life, and in 1825 he was ordained an Anglican priest. He became part of a group of Oxford dons and clergymen with like-minded ideas about renewing the Church of England, which they put forward in a series of pamphlets or tracts. The group became known as the Tractarians, or collectively, the Oxford Movement. It was based around the first of the tightly-knit circles of male friends, which were to be such a feature of Newman's life. Newman became the vicar of the University Church of St Mary in Oxford in 1828. And just before he took over the job, the interior of this medieval church had been redesigned to turn it into what's been described as a Calvinist preaching box. So everyone's attention in the church would focus on this raised wooden pulpit. And it was here that Newman really established his reputation as a preacher. Even on the page, his words have impressed people. The novelist Muriel Spark wrote in an introduction to a selection of his sermons, "It was by way of Newman that I turned Roman Catholic. Not all the beheaded martyrs of Christendom, the ecstatic nuns of Europe, the five proofs of Aquinas, or the pamphlets of my Catholic acquaintance provided anything like the answers that Newman did." And she, of course, had only read the words on the page. His performance was, by all accounts, electric. One of the things that struck people most about him was his voice.
Father Ian Carr is a leading Newman scholar and biographer.
He had this low, thrilling, musical voice which struck people. It's one of the things that struck them, was particularly when he preached. But people remembered that voice. It's echoed through the 19th century. People have intense memories of it. So a sermon in St Mary's was a real event, was it? Yes, the heads of colleges changed the dinner hour in order to try and stop undergraduates going, because the sermons were such a central part of the Oxford or Tractarian movement. Such was his magnetic personality that it was drawing young men into the arms of the Oxford movement. What was the essence of that movement? Well, the original motivation for the Oxford movement began with the state's interference in the church. So the question naturally that raised itself was, what is the church? That was a fundamental question for the Tractarians. And so they went back to the early fathers and began to rediscover a very Catholic conception of what the church is. Because the evangelicals believed, roughly speaking, the church was simply a sort of convenient place where people could get together and preach Christianity. And the main broad church party believed that it was simply more or less a department of state.
Newman's early Anglicanism was evangelical, and he was deeply suspicious of Roman Catholicism. He took the traditional Protestant view that Rome was corrupt. But when he visited the Eternal City for the first time in the early 1830s, he was in awe of its ancient splendour. He even reflected on the possibility of union between the Roman and Anglican churches, but dismissed it as a dream. On board ship on the way home, he wrote a hymn which evoked a spiritual journey. Newman's willingness to change his mind is one of his most appealing characteristics, and there's an especially attractive modesty of ambition about these lines: I do not ask to see the distant seen, one step enough for me. Lead Kindly Light has become a classic. It was also characteristic of Newman that he found the key to his future in the past. During the 1830s, he turned more and more to the study of the early Christian church, and as he immersed himself in the recondite world of 4th and 5th century theological debate, he saw the contemporary Anglican church reflected in history. He writes of an awful similitude between the dead records of the past and the feverish chronicle of the present. A phrase from the 5th century church father Augustine of Hippo suddenly struck him with, as he put it, a power which I had never felt from any words before. Securus judicat orbis terrarum. The whole world is the secure judge, Augustine declared. And to Newman that meant that the Anglican church, tiny in world terms, couldn't simply go its own way. John Cornwall has recently published a biography of John Henry Newman called Newman's Unquiet Grave.
Newman felt that church history teaches us many things about the church today. He saw this continuity between the church from the death of the last apostle right through to the present day, and he was looking for marks of continuity and the integrity of the church. And out of a particular historical incident, a particular heresy, he realized that the Church of England was in heresy, and this meant that his position as an Anglican was untenable.
The last of Newman's pamphlets on Anglicanism, Tract 90, was an attempt to overcome the barriers which divided Roman Catholicism and the Church of England. It was condemned by many of his former Anglican allies and friends, including his bishop, causing Newman great pain. Newman withdrew from Oxford to a small complex of stables and cottages he bought on the outskirts of the city at Littlemore. He established something very close to a monastic community, and the final act in the drama of his conversion was played out there. He was an alchemist with words, forging the gold of great prayer and poetry from his experiences. That's why he's still loved by so many ordinary believers, as well as the theologians who've studied his ideas. One of his best-known prayers emerged from this period of anguish over his parting with Anglicanism.
May he support us all the day long, till the shades lengthen, and the evening comes and the busy world is hushed, and the fever of life is over, and our work is done. Then, in his mercy, may he give us safe lodging and a holy rest, and peace at the last.